So I want to start this deep dive with a number, just a completely staggering figure. $46.3 million.
Wow. Yeah, that is a big number.
Right. That is the price someone paid for a single painting by the artist we are jumping into today. And the funny thing is, the real kicker, if you ask the artist himself about it, he'd probably just shrug.
Oh, totally. He'd probably say the painting essentially means nothing.
Which is the ultimate contradiction. We are talking about Gerhard Richter today, and for those of you listening, he is often cited as the greatest living painter, the Picasso of the 21st century.
Yeah, but he seems completely indifferent to the deep meaning everyone constantly tries to assign to his work.
Exactly. And that is the paradox we really need to unpack, because when you look at his career as a whole, it honestly doesn't make any sense.
It really doesn't.
You walk into a room of his work, and on one wall, you have these hyper-realistic, really soft-focused portraits that look exactly like blurry photographs. Then you turn around, and on the next wall, you have these violent, chaotic smears of bright neon paint.
And then, just to confuse you even further, there's a giant grid of gray squares that looks like a bathroom tile floor.
Yeah. If you didn't know better, if you just walked in off the street, you would bet money it was a group show featuring three or four completely different artists who do not talk to each other.
But it is all Richter, every single piece.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. We have Dr. Lawrence Schaeff's incredible lecture notes covering 15 specific works, plus biographical archives detailing his life from Dresden all the way to Cologne.
And we're going to use those sources to figure out how this one guy managed to become the absolute chameleon of the 20th century.
Right. How does a man who lived through Nazi Germany, East German socialism, and Western capitalism end up using a giant squeegee to question the very nature of what we see?
It is a wild ride. And to understand the squeegee and to understand the famous blur, you really have to understand where he started.
Which takes us to Dresden, 1932.
Yeah. A remarkably heavy time and place to be born.
I was reading through the source material about his family background, and honestly, it reads like a tragic screenplay of the entire German experience in the 20th century.
It's incredibly dark.
It's not just that he lived under the Third Reich as a kid. The ideology was literally sitting at his dinner table.
It was inescapable for him. His father, Horst, was a school teacher, and the notes point out he wasn't really a fanatic, but he was weak.
Right.
He joined the Nazi Party because he felt he had to for his career. He went off to war, and he came back completely broken. He was stripped of his profession and his dignity. Richter essentially watched his father dissolve in front of him.
But the archives mention the women in his family faced something even more horrific.
Yeah, that is the darkest part of his personal history. His Aunt Marianne, she was schizophrenic. And under the Nazi eugenics program, the euthanasia program, she was sterilized and eventually systematically starved to death in a psychiatric clinic.
Just awful. And at the exact same time, he had an uncle on his mother's side who was actually executed for refusing to fight. So within one single family unit, you have the perpetrator, the victim, and the resistor.
And Richter absorbed all of that. You have to picture him as a child playing in the actual rubble of Dresden after the firebombing. That visual, the total destruction, the gray ruin, the complete collapse of moral certainty, it never really left his mind.
So the war ends, the Nazis are defeated, but for Richter, one totalitarian regime basically just gets swapped out for another. Dresden is now in East Germany, the Soviets are in charge.
And this is so crucial for his artistic development. He enrolls in the Dresden Academy, but he isn't free to just paint whatever he wants. He is strictly trained in socialist realism.
It's basically just visual marketing for the state, right?
Exactly. Happy workers, bountiful harvests, glorious strong leaders. It is art functioning purely as propaganda.
No ambiguity allowed.
None at all. The message must be perfectly clear. Socialism is great. And the wild thing is, Richter was actually very good at it.
He was?
Yeah. He painted a massive mural called Joy of Life for the German Hygiene Museum.
Joy of Life. I mean, that sounds incredibly ironic given the trauma in his background.
Oh, it was a total lie. He knew it. He later called all that early work ideological baggage. But at the time, he was successful. He had a solid career, a car, a comfortable life. But internally, he felt completely suffocated.
The turning point, according to the notes, seems to be his trip to the West in 1959.
Yes. He visits Documenta. It's this massive art exhibition in West Germany.
And he sees the work of Jackson Pollock and Lucio Fontana for the first time.
It was a complete shock to his system. He saw Pollock's wild drip paintings and Fontana literally slashing his canvases with a knife.
Just pure expression.
Right. It wasn't about the noble worker or the state. It was about radical, messy individual freedom.
Oh, yeah.
And seeing that, he realized he was essentially living in a prison of images back in the East.
So he makes a break for it, 1961.
Just 2 months before the Berlin Wall officially goes up, he and his wife, Marianne, who he called Ema, they defect to West Germany.
And this is where Richter does something that I think really defines him. He doesn't just cross the border and start a new life. He actively erases his old one.
The great erasure.
He literally burns his art.
Yeah, he took almost all the work he had brought with him or had produced in the East, and he burned it in a fire in the courtyard of the Art Academy in Dusseldorf.
That is just such a violent act. It's not just cleaning out your old studio. It's saying that person, that artist doesn't exist anymore.
He wanted a complete tabula rasa, a blank slate. So he started his catalog raisonné, which is his official numbered list of works, entirely from scratch, from number one.
But he lands in the West, right in the middle of the German economic miracle.
Yeah.
And he doesn't just enthusiastically embrace Western art either, does he?
No, not at all. He meets another artist, Sigmar Polk, and together they come up with this very cynical concept they call capitalist realism.
Which is a direct jab at socialist realism.
Exactly. It was a very sharp, very German response to American pop art. So you have Andy Warhol over in New York painting soup cans and Marilyn Monroe, basically celebrating mass consumerism.
Right.
But Richter and Polk were looking at the West's sudden obsession with buying things, furniture, cars, vacations, and they were deeply skeptical about it.
It feels like they were mocking both sides equally. Socialist realism was a lie about the power of the state, and capitalist realism was a lie about the perfect lifestyle.
Precisely. They even staged this famous, absurd exhibition in a furniture store. They sat on the display sofas as living sculptures while actual confused customers were trying to shop around them.
I love that. It's painting as performance art. But this leads us perfectly to number one in his new catalog. The painting called Tisch, or Table, from 1962.
This piece is the Rosetta Stone for understanding Richter. It starts out as a painting of a very mundane, modern designer table, which he just copied from a newspaper clipping. He paints it realistically.
But he isn't satisfied with it.
No. He looks at it, and then he cancels it.
He takes a brush and just violently swirls gray paint right over the center of the image. He basically defaces his own work.
And you know, usually when an artist completely ruins a painting like that, they throw it in the trash.
But Richter framed it.
Because the ruin was the entire point. That big swirl of gray paint was his declaration of independence. He realized that by destroying the clear image of the table, he was liberating the paint itself.
So he was forcing the viewer to realize it's an illusion.
Exactly. He was saying, this isn't a table. This is a painting of a table. Do not trust the image.
And that distrust of the image seems to be the main engine for what becomes his absolute signature technique, the blur.
The Richter blur. It's what everyone knows him for.
It's so fascinating how he actually achieves it. According to the notes, he projects a photograph onto the canvas, traces it, and then paints it with incredible meticulous detail. I mean, Vermeer levels of traditional detail.
Right. Highly skilled work.
But then, while the oil paint is still wet, he drags a dry brush or a squeegee across the surface to intentionally distort it.
It softens all the edges. It makes it look like a photograph taken slightly out of focus or like you're viewing something through a wet, rainy window.
But I keep coming back to the labor of it. Why go to all that trouble? Why spend weeks painting it perfectly just to essentially mess it up at the very end?
Because Richter argues that the blur makes everything, in his words, equally important and equally unimportant. It's a way of creating an emotional distance.
Distance from what, exactly?
From the reality of the subject. Think about his 1966 painting, Ema, nude on a staircase.
Right, the one of his wife.
Yeah, it's his first wife, descending the stairs of their apartment. It's an inherently intimate moment. But the blur acts almost like a protective veil. You can't quite reach her. She becomes this hazy, secular Madonna.
The notes mention it's also a direct reference to Marcel Duchamp's famous nude descending a staircase.
It is. But where Duchamp completely fragmented the human body into cubist shapes, Richter restores the body, but then blurs it.
It reminds me of how human memory actually works. You don't really remember a moment from 10 years ago in high definition. You remember the feeling, the light, the color, but the edges are always soft.
That connects perfectly to the hazy margin of memory that the critics talk about with his work. But there is another very technical layer here, too. The blur completely hides the artist's hand.
Oh, because there are no brushstrokes.
Exactly. In traditional painting, you see the thick brushstrokes, you feel the artist's ego and emotion. The blur wipes all that away. It creates this smooth, almost machine-like surface.
And he applies this technique to everything. Family photos, toilet rolls, serial killers, and massive cityscapes. Which brings us to Domplatz, Mailand, Cathedral Square.
Milan.
Oh, the huge Siemens Commission from 1968. This is a massive painting, nearly 3 meters wide.
And it sold for $37.1 million in 2013.
A record for a living artist at the time. Richter was hired by the Siemens Corporation to paint something grand for their new offices. But 1968 is a very specific year. You've got student riots, intense protests against capitalism, the Vietnam War. The world is kind of on fire.
And Richter paints the heart of Milan, this grand cathedral square. But he blurs it so heavily that the giant stone buildings look like they are literally trembling. It looks like a ghostly, vibrating vision.
It's so deeply ironic, isn't it? A major corporate powerhouse pays for a picture of stability and establishment power, and he delivers a picture of a world that looks like it's actively dissolving.
He's showing them the fragility of their own institutions. The cathedral, the city, the company itself, it's all just unstable matter in the end.
I want to touch on his process for choosing these specific images. We mentioned he used a random magazine clipping for the table painting, but he has this massive physical archive, right? The Atlas.
The Atlas is monumental. It's thousands upon thousands of photographs, quick sketches, and newspaper clippings that he has been obsessively collecting for decades. It's basically his external brain.
And looking through the source notes, it seems like he treats all images in the Atlas as totally equal. A photo of a fluffy cloud is treated with the exact same seriousness as a horrific photo of a concentration camp.
That is definitely the most controversial part of his philosophy. He levels the hierarchy of imagery. Speaking of clouds, his landscape paintings are a perfect example of how he actively manipulates us as viewers. Look at the painting Wolken, or Cloud, from 1970.
If you look at it, it looks like a masterpiece of 19th century romanticism. Like he stood on top of a mountain and captured the sublime, majestic power of nature.
Except it's a complete fabrication. A fake. He physically spliced different photos of skies from his atlas together. He was essentially photoshopping with oil paint before computers existed.
So it's not a real place.
No. He called these landscapes cuckoo's eggs. They look like one very familiar thing, but they are something else entirely on the inside.
And he explicitly said he found clouds meaningless, right?
He did. He wasn't celebrating Mother Nature at all. He was documenting our desperate human need to see beauty and meaning in random chaos. He knows we look at a beautiful sky and want to see God or some grand design.
Right.
So he gives us the exact image of that desire, but he knows, and he wants us to know, that it's really just random water vapor.
That deep cynicism, or maybe it's just extreme realism, it carries over into how he paints actual people, too. The 48 portrait series from 1971 really stands out to me in the notes.
This was created for the German Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. He painted 48 portraits of famous historical intellectuals. Albert Einstein, Franz Kafka, Igor Stravinsky.
But wait, they're all white men, all dead, and all painted in a very flat gray.
Yes. He took the source images straight from standard encyclopedias,
and
he aggressively standardized them. They are all the exact same size canvas. The faces are all looking slightly off-center in the exact same way.
It feels incredibly sterile to look at, like a bizarre scientific taxonomy of quote-unquote genius.
Richter stated at the time that he was looking for the father figure he never really had. But the actual visual result is quite chilling. By making them all look exactly the same, he completely strips them of their individuality.
They just become a category.
They become a species of history. And the exclusion is deafening. There are no women. There are no non-Europeans. It dramatically highlights how history is artificially constructed and curated by the people who write the encyclopedias.
Okay, so we have the blur, the gray palettes, the photographic realism. And then, right in the 1980s, he picks up the squeegee and goes in the absolute, complete opposite direction.
The free extractions.
Can you describe the actual physical act of this for the listener? Because when I hear squeegee, I think of a tiny tool for cleaning your shower glass. But these things he uses are massive.
They are huge. Some of them are a heavy piece of perspex as wide as the entire canvas. The process is so physical. He lays down thick layers of wet paint, bright screaming reds, acidic greens, bright yellows. Then he takes this heavy rubber-tipped board and physically drags it across the entire wet surface.
It's a completely destructive act, really. He's forcefully scraping away the painting he literally just made.
It is a constant battle between creation and destruction. As he drags it, he smears the colors, he rips the surface open to reveal the hidden layers underneath. And the crazy part is, he has no idea what it will actually look like until the squeegee passes.
He's completely surrendering to chance.
He actually calls it letting a thing come rather than creating it.
And the results? Like Abstracts builds from 1986, which, by the way, sold for $38 million. Mm-hmm. They're just these massive explosions of texture. They look like deep geological layers or like a car crash of vibrant colors.
Right.
It feels like pure emotion, but it's actually generated by a blind mechanical tool.
And that's the genius Richter touch. He removes the artist's hand yet again. In classic abstract expressionism, the brushstroke is supposed to bravely show the artist's inner soul. Richter uses a window washing tool that literally wipes the soul away and leaves just the raw material. The paint itself does all the talking.
But then, just because he apparently can never settle on one single style, he also does the color charts.
Ah, 24 Farben.
Which are literally just grids of brightly colored squares.
Mm-hmm.
It genuinely looks like he went to a local hardware store, grabbed a bunch of paint chips, and glued them to a canvas.
And he didn't even choose the colors or decide where they went on the grid. He used a random number generator to place them.
It feels like he's trying to assassinate the entire concept of artistic composition.
He absolutely is. He's asking us, why do we automatically think red next to blue means something profound? He systematically strips the color of all its emotional weight. It's not angry red or sad blue. It's just visual data.
Wow.
In a way, he completely anticipated the digital, pixelated world we all live in now.
Speaking of emotion, I want to talk about the candle paintings really quickly. Zweikertzen, Two Candles, from 1982.
A huge shift in tone.
Painted during the absolute height of Cold War anxiety in Germany. It's a return to the classic Finitas tradition, right? The reminder of death.
Yes. The quiet burning candle as a symbol of life slowly running out.
And there's this great pop culture connection in the notes. The rock band Sonic Youth actually used one of his candle paintings for the cover of their album, Daydream Nation.
I love that story.
And Richter, who is this giant of the fine art world, he didn't even charge them for it. He just really liked the connection to the gritty, grimy rock world.
It shows he isn't completely detached in an ivory tower. He understands cultural impact.
Which brings me to what I think is his most difficult, most intense work. We've talked about the gray palettes, the blur technique, and his interrogation of history. In 1988, he combines all of that into one cycle of paintings, the Baader-Meinhof cycle, officially called 18 October 1977.
This is definitely the heavy lifting of his career. So to give you context, the Baader-Meinhof group, also known as the Red Army faction, were the great political trauma of West Germany in the 1970s.
Right.
They were young, extreme radicals, literally the children of the Nazi generation, who decided the new democratic German state was secretly still fascist. So they used bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations to fight the government.
And they ultimately ended up dead in a high-security prison.
On October 18th, 1977, the official government story was coordinated suicide. Their radical supporters claimed they were murdered by the state.
And we are not taking sides on that history here. We are just looking at the art. Because Richter paints these figures based directly on the graphic police photos of their dead body.
He paints them in this incredibly deep, somber gray. And heavily, heavily blurred.
This sparked a massive national controversy. I mean, try to imagine a prominent American artist today painting massive, sympathetic-looking portraits of the bodies of the 9/11 hijackers. People were absolutely furious.
The criticism came from everywhere. The political right accused him of making literal saints out of violent terrorists. They thought he was aestheticizing murder. Meanwhile, the left was angry because he showed their icons as defeated, pathetic, broken bodies, not as heroic revolutionaries.
So if he made everyone mad, what was he actually trying to say with these paintings?
He was painting the absolute tragedy of ideology. He explicitly said he was painting, quote, the sorrow for the people who died for nothing.
Wow.
The gray blur intentionally drains the fiery politics out of the image and leaves nothing but the cold silence of death.
It feels like a grim funeral for that entire generation's misplaced anger.
It was. It was a bleak acknowledgement that their extreme radicalism led to a literal dead end in a concrete prison cell. He forces the viewer to look at the sheer human cost without ever endorsing the violent cause.
It's so interesting that he consistently uses gray for history and memory. He once said, gray is the welcome and the only possible equivalent for indifference and creates a sense of quality.
Gray is the color of the blur. It's the ultimate color of uncertainty.
But then, late in his career, he somehow finds vibrant color again in the absolute most unexpected place. The Cologne Cathedral.
This is such a beautiful coda to his long career. In 2007, he is commissioned to design a massive stained glass window for the south transept of the cathedral.
A towering Gothic cathedral. A place of absolute rigid religious certainty.
And Richter, who is an avowed atheist who deeply distrusts all ideology, accepts the job.
The cardinal in charge wanted traditional portraits, right? Martyrs and saints.
Yes, the cardinal wanted a clear, readable story. He wanted traditional religious iconography. And Richter gave him 11,500 tiny squares.
He went all the way back to the color chart.
He did. He created a massive, towering grid of 72 different colored glass squares, arranged entirely by a computer randomizer.
And the notes say the cardinal was not happy about this.
Oh, he didn't even show up to the grand unveiling. He publicly complained that it would fit better in a mosque because it refused to depict human figures.
But when you actually stand inside that cathedral today and look at it,
it is an absolute symphony of light. As the sun moves across the sky, the colored light washes all over the ancient stone floor. It's genuinely overwhelming. Funded entirely by public donations, too.
I think that's the ultimate irony of his life. By flatly refusing to paint a traditional religious image, he created something that feels deeply, universally spiritual.
He bypassed the strict dogma and went straight to the awe. He proved that you don't actually need a rigid message to make people feel something profound.
So as we wrap this up, we've covered the burned paintings in the courtyard, the blurred descending nudes, the chaotic squeegee abstractions, the dead radicals, and the pixelated stained glass windows. When we step back and look at the whole picture, what is the through line here? What is Gerhard Richter actually trying to tell us?
I think it all comes back to that core idea of skepticism. Richter lived through eras where powerful people claimed to possess the absolute truth. Nazism, Soviet socialism.
Yeah.
He saw exactly where that rigid certainty leads. It leads to death camps and secret police.
So his entire body of art is a lifelong rejection of certainty.
Exactly. When he blurs a realistic image, he is saying to you, I distrust this picture. When he uses a giant squeegee to scrape away his own work, he is saying, I distrust my own hand. He is actively teaching us to be comfortable with uncertainty.
The blur isn't a mistake on the canvas. It's actually the most honest way to see the world.
Because reality is inherently blurry. Memory is blurry. History is incredibly blurry. Anyone who tells you they see the past or the future in high definition is probably lying to you.
That is a remarkably powerful thought to hold on to, especially right now. Because if you think about it, we live in a world of 4K screens, instantaneous hot takes, and absolute moral certainty on social media. We constantly demand perfect clarity from everything.
And Richter gently suggests that maybe we should trust the blur a little bit more. Maybe we are actually seeing more of the truth when we finally admit we can't see everything clearly.
A little humility in the face of the image. Are we actually seeing more today, or are we just understanding less? I really like that.
It's a profound lesson in how to really look at things.
Well, I'm definitely going to be looking at clouds a little differently from now on. Dr. Schaeff's notes and those archives were an absolute goldmine for this.
It was a truly fascinating journey to dig into.
That's a wrap for this deep dive into Gerhard Richter. Thank you all so much for listening.
Goodbye.